Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another show of At Home with Victoria, with your host, Victoria Gaither, and co-host, Michael Kay.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of At Home with Victoria. It's a very chilly 8 o'clock here on the East Coast, but I'm absolutely thrilled. Actually, our news lady, Victoria, is away today. She's actually up in New York scouting out skiing locations with her and the doctor. So she'll be back tomorrow night for tomorrow night's show with Sandy Athey. But tonight, I'm so excited. I'm a little starstruck, I'm going to have to say, because this woman I have had, you know, I fell in love with in the 80s when I still had permed hair with highlights. Actress, singer, dancer, and Golden Globe nominee Cynthia Gibb will be joining us tonight. You've seen her in Fame, you've seen her in Gypsy, you've seen her in Youngblood, and many other films, so we're going to go ahead and catch up with what she's doing. She's starring in a new movie called The Cheating Pact that's airing on Lifetime Saturday the 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Again, check your local listings. But before we do that, I found, some of you on Facebook may have noticed, I found this new guy that I'm really digging music-wise. His name is Mike Cavanaugh. You can go ahead and check him out at www.facebook.com/Mike Cavanaugh Music. So before we get to the lovely and talented Cynthia, here's Mike Cavanaugh. Don't go away. Cynthia Gibbon, we get back.
I want to fall asleep and lie here forever. Oh no, I woke up, no voices in my head. I'm gonna tell them to hold their breath, 'cause I'm not listening anymore. So what do I have to do? Who do I have to be? What do I have to say to make you see what you're doing? Short of breath, I'm trying to find a way to clean up this mess you left for me. Tired of waking up. Wanna lie here and dream in your arms. I wanna show you who I am, but you're not listening anymore. So what do I have to do? Who do I have to be? What do I have to say?
Now is the lovely and talented Cynthia Gibb calling in from Vermont. Cynthia, thank you for joining At Home with Victoria tonight. I hear you're in Vermont enjoying the cool weather.
I am so enjoying cool weather. This is New England is
at this time of year is my favorite place in the world to be. It's absolutely beautiful. It's dry. It's cool. The days are sunny and warm. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, no, I enjoy sleeping with the windows open, of course, but then I wake up in the morning and I'm freezing to death, so I have to find that nice balance of when do I turn the heat on, because, you know, I'm one of those cheap guys that just wants to hold off on the heat until absolutely necessary, but I'm that person. Cynthia, you were actually born in Vermont but raised in Connecticut. What was growing up like for you? Were you from a big family, a musical family? How did that all work?
Born in Vermont. We moved when I was 3 and a half, so I really was raised in Connecticut and the New York area, but I still really consider Vermont part of my home because my grandparents were there. My grandfather was a senator, but he was by love and by trade a farmer, gentleman's farmer. He had a big farm outside of Middlebury where the college is, and so all of our vacations were spent there. I mean, virtually year-round, that's where we went for our vacation. So it, and we still spend August there on a lake. So it's my, definitely one of my homes, one of my many homes. Mm-hmm. And, but my parents moved us down here, I think primarily for the education that we could get here. The schools here, well, the schools where I grew up in Westport, Connecticut are blue ribbon schools. And my mom was a dancer. And she wanted to be near New York so she could go in for class. She was a ballet dancer and at the time, and still, I guess, if you want to be a ballet dancer, New York is the place to be. So, they both have very strong influences on me. But we were in a suburb of New York, you know, so it was like theater, dance, music, sports, tennis, horseback riding, sailing, all those waspy things. I don't know. We had it all growing up in Fairfield County. Great.
Yeah. Well, Connecticut's a little bit of a fancy area. Wouldn't that be in Westport and stuff? I mean, that's where the non-poor people would actually summer. Is that correct?
Well, there are absolutely now. Actually, there are some pretty big houses. One of my friends has a bowling alley in his house. It is true. But there are still, you know, modest middle class homes as well. And I would say the attitude, in spite of the prominence of wealth in Westport, there isn't that sense of entitlement that exists in LA, for example. It's still a pretty humble place. People, people are more subtle. They don't show off their wealth the way they do in L.A. They certainly don't talk about it the same way they do in L.A. And people are pretty down-to-earth, actually. We always loved growing up here. You know, the line always was that, you know, it's where Paul Newman lives. Because, actually, Paul Newman apparently met Joanne Woodward doing a play at the Westport Country Playhouse when Paul was already married to somebody else. And he met her and fell in love and I guess he divorced his first wife and married Joanne, and they raised their kids in Westport. So it was always a big deal as a kid to have a Paul Newman sighting. We have sightings of Paul.
Yeah, that would be really interesting to walk around with Paul Newman.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember Christmas shopping, and Paul would be, like, you know, in the sports store, like, seeing Paul write a check. It was very cool.
Wow.
And sometimes, actually, there was a Robert Redford sighting, you know, when they had just done all those movies together and they were very good friends. I think he moved to town for a minute, or maybe he was just visiting, but we had a Robert Redford sighting as well. It was terribly exciting.
Wow. Yes, that would certainly be even for a young boy like myself. But now discovered at 14 by the Ford agency. How did that end up happening?
Oh God. It's kind of a crazy story. How much time do you have?
Honey, we've got the hour. We're going to go ahead and fill it. I want to know everything about you. Because, you know, quite frankly, Cynthia, I'm just going to be a little bit rude and interrupt here, but I grew up with you all through fame and stuff. Like, it was horrible. We had the same hair for a couple years, you know, kind of a thing.
I was going to say, I had a permed hair with highlights, too.
We all did, Cynthia.
I know.
But this is almost like a bucket list show for me to actually be able to talk with you, because I really, you know, I followed your career. Your work in Gypsy was fantastic. We're going to get into that a little bit later. But, it's just a privilege. This is an absolute privilege for me. So just take that to the bank.
Oh, that is so sweet. Thank you so much. I always feel so old when people say I grew up with you. But I guess
Cynthia, we're the same age, so it's a good thing.
Okay. Well, you know what? If people often say, why don't you lie about your age? And I'm like, what's the point? It's all over the internet. So, you know,
yeah.
It is what it is. But the modeling thing was weird. I was just completely obsessed with 17 Magazine as a teenage girl. I mean, really, truly obsessed. I knew all the models' names. I knew everything about that magazine. And I kind of had them all opened up on my floor of my bedroom when I was 13, 14, like a carpet. And my mother kind of took hold of my obsession, and she had a friend in New York, of course, because she was dancing in New York, who was a professional photographer. And I think probably to just get me to shut up already, she had him do a test session, which is what models do with photographers, where nobody pays anybody, but, you know, you just take some photos and everybody gets some photos for their book. Mm. And he did a first test session, and he actually came back to my mom and said, would she do another one? And so anyway, we ended up doing a bunch of test sessions, and one day he called my mother and said, okay, I've put her book together, and by the way, I've set up an appointment for you, so, you know, do you have some time that day? And so she just told me that we had, you know, we were going into the city to pick up my book, and we went, Howard Zager, if he happens to be out there, I have no idea where he is, I haven't talked to him in like 3 decades, but if Howard's out there, I have him to thank for my career. As I walked into his studio and he handed me, you know, I saw this beautiful book he had put together for me, and he said, you've got an appointment at 17 Magazine in an hour. So my mother and I, like, you know, get on the subway, and lo and behold, we end up on Madison Avenue, and I, you know, completely intimidated already, go up in the elevator and the doors open, and then all these enormous, you know, 6-foot-tall posters of all these models who, you know, their stats I knew by heart were all over the wall. And I sat there in the waiting room just blown away that I was even sitting there. And the model editor, who I found again through Facebook, the total trip, Kathleen, Kathleen contacted me on Facebook recently. It was such a joy to hear from her. She came out and took one look at my book, and she said, what are you doing in April? The second week of April, and I said, going to school. And she said, would you like to go to St. Croix? And I said, where is that? And she said, it's in the Caribbean. Would you like to go there with us? And I said, okay. And she said, well, you'll need an agent to do that. So, you know, she handed us, again, we were handed this little piece of paper and said, go here and go meet Claudia. And so, again, we get on the subway, we go to the Upper East Side, walk into this little brick brownstone, basically, in upper 59th and 1st, and it was Ford models. And I sat in the waiting room there having no idea where I was, and this woman sits down next to me. She looks at me, and she, in a very sweet way, she says, will you grow for me? And I said, sure. She said, that's great. She got up, and she hurried away, and my mother said, do you know who that was? And I said, no. And she said, that's Eileen Ford. This is her agency. And I said, okay. I had no idea, but you're my age, so maybe you don't remember. Apparently there was a spaghetti ad on the air that Eileen Ford starred in, and that's how my mother knew who that was. And anyway, I got called in to Claudia. She was the head of the children's division, and she was Brooke Shields' agent at the time.
Wow.
And she took a look at my book, and she said, here's a contract, and do you have a little time? I've got a go-see for you. She handed us this little piece of paper with an address on it. And I walked out the door, and we got on the subway again, and we went over to the studio, and we walk in, and it was Richard Avedon's studio. And
Jesus.
I swear to God, this is my first day in New York. And I walked in, and I handed this man my book, which, I mean, I didn't even know that's what it was called at the time, and he looked at it, and I booked the job. And
wow.
And I made $560 that day. I will never forget. I made $560 on that job, and then I went a good 6 months without booking a thing. But that was the beginning of it all, and it was really great. My mother worked after school, in the afternoon. So after school, I was she handed me a subway map and a bunch of dimes, you know, to make phone calls, and I was on my own.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for the first day to meet Eileen Ford and Richard Avedon and not know who either one of them was, I mean, that's so charming. I just want to puke a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, and I remember, too, I never got a chance to meet Eileen. I had a small modeling agency up in Canada, but I didn't have a chance to meet Eileen. But I met Katie a few times, and I found Katie, I guess Katie took over, actually, when Eileen was getting a little bit older, but fantastic. And one of the top agencies in New York City. But you were also on the cover of Young Miss and Vogue, is that correct?
The Vogue thing is a mistype in wherever. IMDb did that, I think. I was in Paris Vogue. Actually, during that time when I was with Claudia Black ran the children's department at Ford for a very long time. She's the one that signed Brooke Shields and Baby, basically. And while I was there as a teenager, if you recall, the movie Pretty Baby came out. And so all the talk, you know, culturally
was pretty salacious.
And the debate about how unhealthy it is and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so Paris Vogue grabbed hold of that concept, and they did a piece on pretty babies. Mm-hmm. And they went to Ford, of course, and they asked for, you know, who are your top teenage girl models who are being overly made up and photographed a lot. And so it was me and Lori Loughlin and Lisanne Falk were picked for that article, and it ended up in Paris Vogue, but I was not on the cover of Vogue. I was on the cover of Young Miss about two or three times, but not.
Yeah, I saw a couple of the covers actually on your website and stuff, and I tell you, yeah, quite a beauty. How tall are you at this age? Were you a tall child? Because I know.
Oh my God, No, Michael, I never thought I'd be a model. First of all, I had a total, like, ugly complex. I felt very unattractive. So this is, like, totally, I thought, I kept waiting for somebody to realize that. I better not tell them, but they're going to find out sooner or later. No, I was not, I did not feel pretty, first of all. I felt like the ugly duckling always. And I still am not very tall. I'm 5'4" now. But that
was
the thing about being in the children's department. It's just like being an adult model, I guess. You know, the designers make their clothes for a certain size. I think it's a size 8. Maybe it's a size 6. But the models have to fit into the clothes and preferable to be, you know, tall and lean when wearing them because it creates a better silhouette. So as a kid, I was very skinny. Which is one of the reasons I felt really ugly, is because my friends all looked like young women and I looked like a boy. And but it was very good for modeling because still when I was 14 years old, I fit into a preteen 10, which was the size of the sample.
Right.
Kids' clothes, preteen 10, was the sample size. So they needed models for preteen 10. And in fact, when I was like 15, I was the Diane von Furstenberg size 10 model. Preteen 10 model. So like all of their new line, I would go in and they would fit them on me and they would make adjustments. In other words, I wasn't on camera. I was going to their their design house. And they
you were a
put
sample
jeans
model,
on
yeah.
me. And I was a sample model for Diane von Furstenberg because I was a perfect preteen 10 when I should have had breasts and an ass, but I didn't.
Now you can buy all that stuff at Walmart, kind of a thing. But skipping ahead a little bit, let's go to your meeting with Mr. Woody Allen and your appearance in Stardust Memories. And it was a small role, but working with Woody must have been pretty interesting.
That was when I was bit by the bug of like being on set and going, wow, this is cool. I want to do this. The meeting with him totally came out of the blue. And again, Michael, I don't know how any of this happened. I really do believe from a spiritual place that, you know, we're just, I think, supposed to go with whatever inspires us, and then the doors will open, because there is no reason on the planet that I ever should have been a model, and there's no reason on the planet that Woody Allen should have called and asked for me. I still, to this day, do not know how I got that job, because he literally was casting person Juliet Taylor called my booker at Ford and specifically asked to see me. I mean, it wasn't an open call. They didn't, you know, call in. She called and asked to see me, said it was a request from him. I have no idea. I never got an answer from anybody about how that went down. But, you know, I remember going to his apartment on a Saturday afternoon and standing on line in the hallway behind many, many people on this casting call. And literally the hallway of his apartment building on the Upper West Side, just standing there in the hall, and one by one people were invited into his apartment and sat in the living room, and he would chat with you for like 60 seconds or less. And then he said, thank you very much, and you'd leave. And so it was like, hi, how are you? How old are you? And I was like, 15. He said, what do you do? I say, I got a school. What do you do? I mean, that was literally the whole conversation. And then I booked the job. And if you see the movie now, the back of my head is in it for about 10 seconds. But I shot 10 days on it over the course of like 3 months. And and yeah, I just found the experience of being on set to just be so fun. And he was really nice. He actually, I remember one lunch hour when everybody else was at lunch, I was standing on set. There was a set of a train. There was like a whole train in this soundstage. And I was just amazed by that. And I was walking around checking it out, and he was there. And when he talked with me for a while. But now that we know, you know, it's the way he feels about young females, it's
I was going to go there, but I thought you might as well walk that path first. Yeah.
I who knows? I'm just saying. I'm not taking that one personally that he had to take their interest in me. I think I was just the right age.
That's hilarious. After that, Search for Tomorrow, Susie Martin, Wyatt Carter, a couple years there, and then we go right into Fame. I don't mean to go ahead and glaze over for Search for Tomorrow, but Fame. How did you end up getting that? Was that a general cattle call that you got in on and stuff? Because I mean, that was a very successful series, running for 6 seasons, 3 Golden Globe Awards for the series itself. I know you're only with it for 3, but how did you end up getting the role as Miss Holly Laird?
That came through as a normal procedure. What happens is with a show like that, and even still today, they have a casting director who's on staff, and whenever there's a new role, whether it's a guest star or a series regular, they send out what's called a breakdown, and it'll be, you know, searching for female, this age, you know, these qualities, blah, blah, blah. And so I got sent up on it by my agent in New York, and got several callbacks along the way and ended up being flown to L.A. for a screen test at MGM, which was really exciting. That was the first time I'd done anything on that level before. And then when I got back to New York, I found out I was still in the running, and they had me do another screen test, but in that one I had to sing and dance. Mm-hmm. And then I found out I got the part. And then the next week I found out that NBC had canceled the show.
Wow.
Because up until that point, the first 2 seasons, NBC had, I believe it was NBC, it was a network series at that point.
Right.
And I just remember thinking, well, this can't be. I just got the job on the show. The show can't be canceled. And, you know, obviously some talks went down. And it was, Fame was the first series television show to go to syndication immediately. In other words, syndication is what happens when a show's made 100 episodes on networks, then
right.
It's sold to syndication, which are smaller markets. And so in this particular case, Fame was so popular that somehow MGM went out and they found small networks around the country who agreed to buy the show for a first run. And and then the show lasted at least another 5 years, I think. I mean, I was on it then for seasons 3, 4, and 5, and it stayed on at least 2 more seasons, I thought.
Yeah. What was like working with the cast? I raced home to go ahead and watch it and everything like that, and it looked like everybody was just having fun. There were 2 shows on during this time. There was Fame and there was The Paper Chase. When I watched Fame, I wanted to be a singer or a dancer, and then when I watched The Paper Chase, I wanted to be a lawyer. So it just depended on what mood I was in. But again, it's the camaraderie, I think, that lends to the magic of a series.
Oh, my God. That was the most fun I have ever had, and I did not appreciate it. I mean, I was having fun, but if I could go back today and do that show, I would have never left that show. I mean, I actually asked to leave after 3 seasons, because at that time, my agent had got me several film roles, and television actors didn't do film, and film people didn't do television roles, and he's like, this is your chance, you're going to be a film actress, so we have to pull you off of that show. And I got to say, I mean, if I had it all over to do, I would stay on Fame, like, for the rest of my life. It was so fun. The level, first of all, when I entered that show, I was so intimidated because everybody was so talented. I definitely felt like it was a mistake that I had been cast, and again, I felt like everybody was going to find out that I didn't belong.
the jig was up.
I hear that's a fear of success belief system, you know, fearing that somebody's going to find out that you're just a charlatan. In spite of the fact that, I mean, at that point, I grew up with a mother who was a dancer. I had been in dance class or around dance my entire life, and I had played violin. This is another thing I totally regret. I never told the producers that I was a violinist when I got that job, which was so stupid because they were trying to replace Laurie Singer, who was the cellist. But I was a violinist at the time, but I was so terrified of playing in public that I never told them. I don't know if Bill Glynn, our executive producer, knows that, but yeah, it was really stupid of me. But I had also, so I'd been a musician as well, and I had already, you know, been acting, I don't know, for 4 years professionally or something at that point. So I had the credentials, but I was so intimidated by the level of the talent of those people, and I still take my hat off. Like if you go onto YouTube, for instance, and YouTube Life is a Celebration, and I wasn't even on the show yet, and you look at Michael DiLorenzo dancing the lead part in that big group dance number, you see the level of skill, and it used to blow me away. I mean, we had dancers who were at American Ballet Theatre, you know, New York City Ballet. They came from the cream of the crop, and they could learn that choreography in, you know, in like half an hour. Debbie would teach it, they'd know it, and they could go perform it. And I'd be there in rehearsal hall going, I don't get it. You know, everybody going, I'm going left and everybody else going right. I mean, they were so good, and they could do all genres of dance. I mean, you could give them a tap routine, you could give them jazz, you could give them ballet, and the dancers could do it all, and the actors were emotional, and we really did dance and sing, like, on the furniture in between takes.
Yeah.
I mean, that looks like it's, you know, you're going to go like, oh, they didn't really do that. Well, if you were driving down the MGM lot, down our road, our little lane. We were on the northern end of the lot. We had that whole northern end, and so cars of people who were in our group were allowed to drive onto the lot down there. And if somebody just parked their car and had the radio blasting, literally, like, people would be dancing on the car.
Yeah.
Just partying. And Gene Anthony Ray and a bunch of the dancers, Gene Anthony played Leroy. He would steal the MGM security guy's golf carts and go ride around the lot. And you'd hear these guys on the walkies going, cart stolen, stolen cart, same kids, stolen
same
cart.
Kid.
Same kid.
That's hilarious. Yeah, you know, it. Like I said, I can only imagine what kind of electric energy that is because, of course, you're having everybody on the same sort of, no matter how you felt about yourself, the same level of talent. So that kind of energy feeds off each other. I do the Indie Soap Awards, the red carpet there every year, and just being around the level of filmmakers, these are all indie people who no one's making any money, but everybody wants to go ahead and try and make it big and stuff like that. You can just feel the buzz in the room, which I'm sure you felt that many, many times. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, though, because on your first hiatus with Fame, you actually, that was when you did the Youngblood with Patrick and Rob, right?
Yeah.
Like, those are two of the ugliest men on the planet. I mean, what was that like for you?
Well, I spent 3 months one summer in a hockey rink with Rob Lowe, Patrick Swayze, and two hockey teams. It was...
Poor thing.
Let's just say I clung to the few women in the crew because there was a lot of testosterone around. Patrick was actually already married to Lisa, which is one of the things that I loved about him. And he always looked at least a decade younger than he was. I think he was 30 when we made that movie. I was 20.
Really?
And I think he was 30, and we were playing the same age. You know, he was playing like 18. And he had met Lisa as a teenager, and he was married to her already. And he was, as far as I know, as faithful as they come. Like, he wasn't out, you know, in the bars, trolling for chicks. You know, he was home alone talking about how much he missed his wife. Rob, different story, but I'll end there. And a lot of the hockey players were, they were junior A league players at the time, teenagers playing, you know, you must know that if you know about Canada.
Yeah.
And a lot of them ended up playing professionally. I know Peter Zezel was, he was one of the young hockey players on Youngblood's team, and he ended up with the Philadelphia Flyers. And a bunch of them did. I lost track of them. But, yeah, a lot of guys. I learned how to drive a Zamboni.
Yeah, well, you know, that's quite a, and that's an actual, people, ladies and gentlemen, it's an actual thing that cleans the ice. It's not an, another word for something else, the Zamboni, but.
No, thank you so much.
Absolutely. You know, if you're not from Canada, you may not, you know, pick that up. But let's go forward a little bit to Oliver Stone. I know you were fantastic playing a nun that was raped and murdered in the film was called, refresh my memory,
Salvador.
I think it was called Salvador.
It was
called absolutely.
Salvador. And a lot of your listeners, if they're, I think the ones who are, you know, over 50 are the only ones who might even vaguely recall that in Central America in the 80s, there was a very, very gruesome war funded by the United States and the CIA, thank you very much, in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And so Oliver Stone, being the kind of filmmaker that he is, decided to expose, you know, expose the hypocrisy and wrote this movie. And could not get it made. I actually, a little trivia there. I was with the agency CAA, Creative Artists, when I got cast in this movie. And Paula Wagner, who is Tom Cruise's producing partner, was one of the top agents at CAA at the time. She represented Tom, among other people. Mm-hmm. And that project was handed to her. And it was this little indie thing. Oliver hadn't made Platoon or anything big at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was a writer prior to that. I mean, that was, you know, what his paid credits were for, was for writing. And Paula had absolutely no interest in this, and she said, there's no way anybody's going to make this movie, and you know, I don't have time for this. And she tossed it to my agent, who was a junior agent at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Menschel went ahead and put Jim Belushi and James Woods and me in it, and then showed up down in Mexico where we shot it, and proceeded to sign Oliver and put himself on the map with that, because then Oliver's next movie was Platoon, which he won the best
best picture.
Was it best director or best picture?
Best picture and director, I believe, for Platoon.
So yeah, we went to the Academy Awards that year to see Oliver pick up his award, but. The movie was really, really, it was what they called guerrilla filmmaking, which I didn't know what the term meant at the time, but it meant we were, like, driving through literally military roadblocks in Mexico. Mm-hmm. I mean, we weren't even in El Salvador. We would have been, like, bombed there.
Yeah.
We had military, there was, like, military cover of us. There was a sensor. A government, Mexican government censor on set, making sure that what we were filming was actually in the script. The Central America at the time was just on fire, literally and figuratively, and we were in a really tenuous situation making the film. But it shows, I think. It's a really gritty film. It's really upsetting, and... And when we made
hard to look at at times, seriously.
It's really gruesome. And it's so interesting because when it was made, the U.S. government just totally poo-pooed it as being, BS, that there was no truth to it. And then it was like a good 20 years before, you know, everybody had forgotten about that war. And so then all that information got declassified by the CIA, and it turns out that everything he put in that movie was true, every last bit of it. But then when that got declassified, nobody cared anymore, you know.
Well, I think that's usually how they do it, just trying to go ahead and they're going to throw a shiny object over there, so you look over there for a while and forget about, you know, the dead animal in the ditch. And, you know, that's happened several times throughout, of course, history, and it's happening right now. And Michael Moore is, I think, I don't know what you think about him, but I think he's a pioneer, and I really applaud his guts for really going to the nth degree and trying to bring truth to America through filmmaking. But again, that's not a hard road, or not an easy road, I'm sorry. Because,
yeah, no,
you know,
I think he's great.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No problem. Let's go ahead and lighten the mood up a little bit. You worked with one of my favorite stars of all time, Miss Bette Midler, in the television remake of Gypsy as Gypsy Rose Lee. For someone who doesn't think she's sexy and can't dance, my lord, you certainly proved the world wrong in that. That must have been a hoot and a holler to do with Miss Bette.
That, yeah, you know what? That's right up there with fame in terms of probably just the world's best job. And in fact, the producers of that are friends of mine since the 80s, and they're the ones responsible for bringing musicals back to, you know, to American general audiences. They're about to do Sound of Music. They did Chicago. They did Smash. They produced the Academy Awards last year, Neil Marin and Craig Zaden, and they know how to do this. It took us 14 weeks to make that movie, and for a TV movie, that is unheard of, because now they shoot them in 10 to 15 days, and we had 14 weeks. And we did, I guess, 8 weeks of rehearsal and 6 weeks of shooting, and Bette was just a powerhouse. I learned a ton from her. And the other people in the show were Broadway superstars. I mean, the women who played the strippers, Linda Hart is a huge star. She's still on Broadway. Christine Ebersole, same thing. Huge stars.
Yeah, love her.
Andrea
yeah.
Martin. I mean, these people. Who played my grandfather? Lou. Oh, Lou. Come on, Mary Tyler Moore's boss, Lou. Ed Asner.
LeGrand. Ed Asner, I'm sorry. LeGrand.
Ed Asner played my grandfather. I always think of him as Lou. You know, Mary Tyler going, oh, Lou. just an amazing, amazing experience. And my favorite part of the whole thing was that the wardrobe designer was Bob Mackey. So after my whole childhood of watching the Carol Burnett show, where they used to say, who makes your gowns? And she always say, oh, they're Bob Mackey gowns. I finally worked with Bob Mackey and had all these gowns made on me. I mean, they were literally, you call it having them built. These gowns were built on me. And, oh, God, I've got them in my closet, actually, and they're so fabulous. I just need some place to wear them.
Do you ever just go ahead and get you know, pull up with a little bit of Chardonnay and just start trying on your outfits from that movie? Because the wardrobe in Gypsy was fantastic.
Oh, you have no idea. If you actually, that red gown, the strip gown, the last one.
That's exactly what I'm thinking about.
The whole thing off. That one weighs like 20 pounds. It's all hand beaded. And it's fabulous. No, I have nowhere to go. I have nowhere to wear it to. It just sits in my closet.
I may drive down to Vermont and I'll bring some Chardonnay and we'll just go ahead and try on your gowns. How's that? They may be a little big on me. I'm just kidding. But now, I just want to make this a side note, too. I haven't actually met Bette in person, but I have seen her live in a few concerts, and I watched her her last thing for HBO, the Showgirl Never Rests or whatever. Her energy level blows me away. She's like a hummingbird when she's on stage. Have you ever seen her in show?
I have. Look, we recorded the musical numbers live for Gypsy.
Oh, really?
They did them with a click track, which is what we also did for Fame, where you can always go in the studio, and if anything needs correcting, the click track is just a pulse underneath it that the audience doesn't hear, but it allows them, you know, to correct anything that doesn't go right in the studio, but everything was done live. So any of the songs that I performed with her or that she performed, you know, where I was present in the scene, I felt it. It is true. It's like that, what is that commercial? It's not for Bose. It's for the speakers where the guy's in the armchair and then the music
plays.
Oh,
Blown Away, yeah.
And the chair and the hair, everything blows backwards. That's what it's like being in the same space with Bette when she performs. And then what's really extraordinary about it is that she's just like 5 foot nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know exactly how tall she is, but she's like 5 foot or 5'1", I think.
Yeah, she's about 5'1", that's for sure. Yeah, she I'm marveled by her all the time. Now, let's go to another made-for-television movie that was so brilliantly done by yourself and the Karen Carpenter story, which, I mean, I grew up with the Carpenters, you grew up with the Carpenters, I love their music and everything. Was it terribly difficult for you to go ahead and portray Karen in that? Because that the subject matter of that, too, was, you know, really gritty because it showed a side of Karen that I think the public didn't get a chance to know, and I don't think she wanted the public to know. Would you agree?
Oh, I would totally agree. The family was very private. In fact, even when we made the movie, let me start with this. Richard Carpenter was producer on that, and he hired me. They'd been having trouble, you know, casting it, and I think he hired me a week or maybe 2 weeks before they started filming. So they were a part of the production. I will say that they were terribly uncomfortable with the telling of the story to the extent that when we showed up daily, there were cuts or rewrites all the time. We had a very amazing writer on the show. He had won an Academy Award the year before. He had done an amazing script, and it really got slashed by the time. Like, the end product, what you see now, is not what he wrote. Because
wow.
It was slashed, and they really whitewashed so much of story. But it was really a painful story, and you know, people don't end up with eating disorders so severe that they die from them if everything is just peachy and perfect at home. You know, there are contributing factors to that disease that start at home and with the messages you get at home. And the family never acknowledged that it was an emotional disorder. It was always just a physical disorder where if Karen just gained some weight, everything would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was hard on her because she was seeking treatment, which meant emotionally uncovering things and working through things with her family, but her family didn't believe in psychiatry or anything like that. They felt it was a private matter. And so they weren't supportive of her treatment. So her ability to get better was really hindered by their inability to participate. So the story was really sad, and she was a brilliant musician. If you listen to her, you know, they didn't have auto-tune back then, and she had like near perfect pitch.
Yeah.
As well as this beautiful quality to her voice. It was very hard shooting that movie. We shot in their house. I was wearing Karen's clothes. And
really?
Yeah.
That would have screwed with my mind a little bit too.
All those clothes that I wore were from Karen's closet, and we shot in their home. And want to get really creeped out, one of the first things we ever shot was the last scene of the movie where she has died, and the paramedics pick her up, and they put her on the stretcher, and they bring her out to the ambulance. And so sure enough, we're shooting it in Downey, California, in the Carpenter's home. And the paramedics who ended up showing up to play the scene, like the producers had just called, you know, whatever, Downey paramedics and asked to have two guys sent over to be extras. They were the same guys that had actually taken her away.
Oh, God.
And it goes on and on like that. We shot at the same soundstage where they used to record their music at A&M. And, there was a lot. There were times that, honestly, and I might sound a little woo-woo too, but there were times that I really felt like she was there. watching us.
Yeah.
It was all just very, very close.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, a little too close. Singing for decades now, you're actually, you teach private singing lessons in L.A. and Connecticut. Tell us about Dr. Joel Ewing. After reading your pages and stuff like that, you speak so very highly of him. So tell our listeners exactly who he is.
You know, he doesn't believe in self-promotion, so he has never advertised a day in his life, but I am here to promote him to say that he is the vocal coach of the Stars in L.A.
Right.
Seth Riggs is quite well known in L.A., and he has had, you know, Michael Jackson and others in his studio. But Dr. Ewing is the one responsible for rebuilding Steve Perry's voice of Journey after he fell out. He has a lot of opera stars. One of his students and one of my classmates is the highest paid and younger cantor in the world. In the entire, you know, religion of Judaism, he is at the top temple. And he is the top cantor in the world, and he's 27 years old. He's been with Joel for 7 years. So I can't say enough about Joel. I started working with him when I was 19, my first month on Fame, where I was completely intimidated and afraid to go to the recording studio. And, he has taken me through classical training, pop training, musical theater training, master chorale training, and now and how to teach singing, because if you think about it, you could be, you know, one of the best singers in the world and have absolutely no idea how to turn around and teach someone else how to do it.
Correct, yeah.
Because you have to be able to hear what's going on internally in the other person's instrument and then know how to give that student exercises to address the vocal faults. And anyway, that's what I've learned with him over 30 years, and he is, he's just amazing. He's a great, he's responsible for my two careers. I wouldn't be where I am without him.
Well, you got to have a little bit of raw talent too, Cynthia. So, Dr. Joel Ewing, you're a genius, and you're a genius for spotting good talent in Cynthia. Let's just go ahead and say that. Now, you got a brand new, you're starring in a brand new movie coming out on September 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Again, check your local listings for the exact time, but it's called The Cheating Pact, which the subject matter is very interesting because I suspected there was cheating at the university level, but not to the extent that the movie goes ahead and suggests. So tell us a little bit about what the Cheating Pact is all about.
Well, it plays on the theme that you just mentioned where, you know, teens have to take the SAT and the ACTs, you know, standardized testing to get into a good school. Or you know, that's the myth, right? It's like if I go backwards, it's like we're brought up with this myth that to be happy, you have to make a lot of money. And to make a lot of money, you got to have a good job, and to get a good job, you got to have a good education, and so to get a good education, you got to get into a good college, so to get into a good college, you got to have good scores.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you start from there, the movie, which is fictional, starts with a bunch of teenagers in high school who are feeling a tremendous amount of pressure to get into a good school, and therefore, they've got to get good grades on, they don't call it the SAT, I forget what they call it, the CAT or something, college admission test, I think. And the pressure comes from, you know, their peer group, but in some cases it comes down really heavily from the parents, and so they feel this need to do whatever it takes to get a good score on their test. And so this group of teens, they convince this brainiac girl that they know who needs money because she's not as wealthy and well-off as they are. They convince her to take the test for them. And, of course, conveniently, they all have androgynous names like Taylor or, you know,
right.
Whatever. I forget what all the character names are. But,
Heather,
you know,
Connie, Jordan, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so they find a way to have this person take their standardized test for them. And, of course, you know, when that happens, things can never go smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets to be a very dangerous situation for all of them. Not only, I mean, you know, people are hurt, and the law gets involved, people are arrested, and the moral of the story is don't cheat. It's not worth it.
Seems like a simple rule, but yet everybody's trying to always get around the rules and everything. Your role as Brenda in this, are you a pivotal character?
I am the mother of the girl that gets accused for the murder. There's a murder.
Oh.
Of course there's a murder.
Is she?
Of course there's a murder. And my daughter gets accused for that murder, but she's innocent. And being the lion-like, the lioness-like mother that I am, I find a way to vindicate my daughter. No.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to watching it once again. The Cheating Pact is a Lifetime world premiere starting on September 28th, 8 p.m. Again, check your local listings for that. Cynthia, I'm sad to say we're running out of time, but I will say what a lovely treat speaking with you again. Please feel free. Are you actually going to record an album yourself and get something musically out there? Come on, baby.
I don't know. I'm so busy getting my students' jobs. I don't know. I guess one of these days, before I die, Michael.
Okay. Well, I'm going to hold you to that. And then when you do that, please go ahead and come back to the Home of Victoria. I'd love to go ahead and talk with you again.
That's so sweet. Thank you so much. Thanks for your interest and your time.
Oh, honey, you're Cynthia Gibb, lady. I know exactly who you are. So once again, huge love, and tune in to The Cheating Pack on Lifetime at 8 o'clock on Saturday the 28th. But Cynthia Gibb, it's always a pleasure, and I can't wait to talk to you again.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, darling. Have a good night. Take care.
Good night. Bye-bye.
That is Cynthia Gibb. Ah, what a thrill talking to her. Always a nice thing to have a little a bucket list checked off your list. But I want to give special thanks to Ashley Emmerich and Chad, Bob Slight's listening, Mike Cullop, my brother from another mother, and Shannon Sibbold in the chat room from the UK. I want to remind everybody that Alex Guthrie will be playing at Brewer's Alley on Tuesday, October 1st at 124 North Market Street in Frederick, Maryland. Call 301-631-0089 for directions. No cover charge, and just a lot of drunk people enjoying the great music of Alex Guthrie. And close up the show with. I hope you had a great time tonight. I am Michael Kay for At Home with Victoria. Victoria's back tomorrow night with Sam Acey. So once again, as I scroll up looking for Alex Guthrie, and where is he? There we go. We're going to go ahead and listen to Alex with Put Your Guns Away. Thanks a lot. Have a good night.
Loving you, touch is tender and warm. You show me the meaning of taking by storm. You've been pulling at my heartstrings with no sign of quitting. And for once in my life, I don't feel committing. But the days do come, and I gotta ask why. Why you push me away with the tear in your eye? I'm confused and I'm bruised, but I love you so deep. So I smile at those big blue eyes and I leave. Well, I see what you mean and I hear what you say, but I don't understand all the games that you play. So come on now, put your guns away. The Napier neck never smelled so sweet. Lying down by the dark, face to face, cheek to cheek. Wrapped up in your blanket, we'd hide from the wind. Then that your mother wasn't calling again. I can tell what you want from that look in your eye, but you still choose to give. give me an angry goodbye. I see what you mean and I hear what you say, but I don't understand all the games that you play. So come on now, put your guns away.
With Victoria, an interactive news and entertainment show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Download us on iTunes as a free podcast and like us on Facebook. I'm Shelly Rand, musician and announcer for At Home with Victoria. Download my CD on iTunes and Amazon and friend me on Facebook.